This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Brianna Younger writes and edits the music listings in The New Yorker, and she covers, well, whoever's playing in the city, whoever's worth listening to and knowing about. So she is just marginally hipper than I am, a tiny bit, almost unnoticeable, really. Brianna, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. So you recently visited with a musician named Thundercat. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, Thundercat is a bassist from California. He comes from a family of musicians. He initially rose to prominence in the punk band Suicidal Tendencies. And in the time since, he's kind of made the rounds working with people like Erykah Badu, Childish Gambino, and probably most famously Kendrick Lamar.
So Thundercat, as I understand it, played on To Pimp a Butterfly, which is the biggest of Kendrick Lamar's recordings, right?
Absolutely. That album was really a sort of game changer, not just for hip-hop, but for music as a whole. And jazz especially kind of really reaped the benefits from that and kind of had a resurgence with people who maybe weren't previously following jazz like that. And Thundercat was a huge, huge part of that album. One of the sonic architects. Maybe that might be overstating it. But
what does that mean? What was the contribution specific?
Well, Thundercat helped produce as well as played bass on the album. So it's a very jazz-inspired hip-hop album, and it's phenomenal.
Dark is the midnight hour, her bright is the morning sun. Give a f*** about your complexion, I know what the germ has done. Sneak. Sneak me through the back window, I'm a good feel. Girl, I made a flower for you out of cotton just to chill with you. You know I go the distance. You know I'm 10 toes down, even if Mass are listening. Cover your ears, he about to mention complexion.
So he was close to the rapper Mac Miller who died last year, right?
Yes, they were very close. They worked extensively with each other as much as they worked with other people. They were planning to go on tour together before Mac passed away. So I just kind of wanted to check in with him about grief and how it kind of plays out publicly in like the social media era.
Where did you meet up with Thundercat?
We met at the infamous Blue Note.
A club downtown in New York.
I guess we'll start with where we are now, like with you in the midst of this residency. Like, how has that been going so far? Like, this is your first residency of this
ever.
Caliber?
Yeah.
Oh, ever?
Yeah, like I've never had a residency before.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So people know you from To Pimp a Butterfly. A lot of people, at least, were introduced to you that way. But you also, you know, have a long resume from Suicidal Tendencies to playing with Erykah Badu. But let's go to the very, very beginning. And what even made you pick up a bass to begin with?
Well, I think I just had a natural affinity for like swords and, you know, sticks. You know, it's like there's that one kid that, you know, like you always got to tell him to put stuff down or he's just playing a little too rough with things. There's a bit of that. But then there's also mostly my dad that inspired me because it's like growing up in a house of musicians. You know, it's not saying that, I mean, it's indirectly saying you're going to play an instrument. Like, it doesn't matter, you know. It's intense, you know, and it's like, it's not always for the faint of heart, when you have a family that does music, because everybody has an opinion, you know, everybody feels things differently, and you have to respect that. But, you know, it's like, it's just, you learn and you grow. You still grow and learn together, but it's like, it's just different. Me and my older brother would grow up playing together more than me and my younger brother. And in growing up with my older brother being, you know, that he's this virtuoso drummer, it was very intimidating, but it caused me to grow. You know, if I didn't have my brother around, I wouldn't play the way I play.
Some of your early records, like Young Jazz Giants, sound more in the vein of traditional jazz than, you know, as your work as Thundercat. How did you develop that sound and what would become the Thundercat voice over time?
The real thing is that I started writing music from my instrument. And a lot of the time when you have an instrument that you play, it can become a bit of a role, you know, where, like I was saying, you start to fall into the idea of, like, I'm working, so it's cool. But I would push out a bit, you know, and because I didn't play piano, you know, because I wasn't like this guy trying to be this R&B singer, I would always create from my bass. And once I realized that that was an option, it kind of took on its own life.
You've talked in the past about kind of your decision to play six strings versus four strings and how, like, in your collaborations with other artists, that was kind of a thing where people may have wanted you to play more contained or essentially to shrink yourself. So why the six string? Like, what are some of the nuances of that, and how has it allowed you to become the artist that you saw yourself as?
It's like, you know, like I would say, like, sometimes when people see the six string, it's immediately intimidating, or it's immediately denotes to you're about to play too much. It's just like, but a lot of the time, I would be writing, and that would be the best tool to write with for me because it gave me the most facility. And I wouldn't always take it out with me, but I would always be playing a six string on records that I would record for myself. It didn't become a reality until I had my other basses stolen, where I had to take that bass out, and that's where it started.
So your sense of humor is such a big part of what people know of you. Like, it's in your records, it's in your interviews. Like, anytime people hear Thundercat, it's a very lighthearted kind of situation. But, you know, life gets real, and that's also in the records. And
yeah.
I feel like Drunk was, like, the perfect culmination of I'm this funny guy, but also it's not always great.
Yeah.
Nobody move, there's blood on the floor. And I can't find my heart. Where did it go? Did I leave it in the cold? So please give it back, cause it's not yours to take. It must have felt when I lost.
You know, music sometimes can be like therapy. It can be, you know, soft and gentle, or it could be really, you know, intense and abrasive. And I don't know. I feel like humor is for the soul. You know what I mean? Like, it helps you get through. Even if it hurts, it's still better to laugh, I think.
One of the hardest things that I would imagine about being an artist is those tough times and the idea that you're expected to kind of process things in this very public way.
Yeah.
Obviously you've dealt with a lot of loss in your lifetime, but is that something you're feeling now with the recent loss of Mac and this idea that you'll be expected to somehow process this on your next record?
Well, I think it's the inevitable, first of all. It's like real life in art, you know, the imitation thing is real. I don't think it's expected. I mean, if I put out a trap album next, that's, I would imagine that's just as expected.
Fair enough.
But it's just, it's it moments like that, it's just what it is. It is what it is. I can't make up for something as precious as a life lost like Max. You know, it's no way it's not going to touch different places in my life, you know. There was a movie that came out some years ago with Denzel Washington and John Goodman, and it was about this like demon that would follow him through the city.
Oh, Fallen?
Fallen. You remember it? There were moments like after he died that felt a bit like Fallen or like They Live, because it was like everybody was in my personal life in that one moment, and I couldn't walk down the street without somebody looking and saying, I'm sorry, or like look, trying to catch my eyes. And it was a bit intense for me at first, but the truth is everybody mourns, you know, and Mac didn't just touch my life. That was just what that was proof of. And I had to see through that, you know, and like realize it is bigger. Again, it's bigger than me, you know. So my processing of it is, like I said, it's going to get touched.
Back to Pimp a Butterfly. Was that different than anything you've done prior?
Oh, yeah. That was a very demanding moment, you know. To this day, I still think, I look back on it and I think about how much output was going on in that moment. And along with that, you know, realizing that is the genius of Kendrick Lamar's writing, and like, it's rare, you know. It's like a lot of the time, especially in the rap game, rappers get far off into thinking it's just them. Kendrick was not afraid of anything. Like, and that would inspire me all the time. He would run up on all of it. We would have conversations about Joe Henderson. We have, you know, talk about those Miles albums. We talk about all kinds of stuff like that. It was just this continuous dance of like, it was almost like a trust fall. It was like, I didn't know where I was going. And it was one of those things where when that album was finished, being there for the very last mastering session up until 7-8 o'clock in the morning, and I went home, I almost fainted and cried, because it was just so, I was like, I had gone as far as I felt I could. I had given as all I could. You know, if I had lost like 100 pounds, that would have made sense, you know, but it was just like, I put my all. That's what I have from that, you know. It's like, and then we look up, and then it's, you know, it's like, oh, 11 Grammys. We were like, Jesus, you know. It's like,
I was gonna say, did you know? Did you know it would be this?
No, I didn't even have a suit on at the Grammys.
It really changed jazz and improvisational music. Yeah.
It wasn't just the awards. It became a political statement. You see what it sparked. As much as everybody, there's moments in history when we look back, there's Dave Chappelle, there's Barack Obama, and then there's that time when Kendrick put out To Pimp a Butterfly. And it pushed, it made people uncomfortable. It made everything a bit disheveled. It brought the cream to the top. It shook everything up. And I think this album is definitely one of those albums that when we look back, it will stand the test of time of how,
oh, of course,
you know, it's just, thank Kendrick for being the vessel, you know what I mean? Like letting it happen. Cause he could have easily been like, you know, I'm gonna just put out this trap album.
I think you have a trap album on the way. You keep saying this. I think you're hinting.
You think I'm joking.
What excites you the most about the music industry right now, this moment we're in, where all these types of music are kind of dialoguing with each other? And on the flip side of that, what scares you the most?
Starting, you know, going a bit backwards, what scares me the most? I had this moment last night with Zach Fox, also known as Booty Math, where we were talking about this young rapper. I think it's Young Melly.
Yes, YNW Melly.
That scared the hell out of me. For those who don't know, it's a young rapper from, was it Florida?
Florida.
Yeah, and you know, he basically murdered his best friends
Allegedly.
And, yeah. Like hearing the music, it was so real. It was just, it almost like it sent chills up my spine. I was just like, what if this was actually his art? In his mind, this was the art to him. You know, we always talk about gangster rap and stuff like that and how volatile it was back in the 90s and 80s. But this is like real murder music. So the part where the line gets blurred like that, it's scary, man, because it's like the music is jamming.
Facts.
Yeah.
Facts.
Like it's hands down. He can sing. He could kill it. He's rapping. And it's good. So that being, a darker point, I guess a more exciting point for me is the part where, I don't know, I just feel like the music is still growing and changing and flourishing and stuff like that. So I'm always like excited about the idea of what can't be, what we can do, what we're capable of doing. You know, now it's trap music. Who knows what it's going to be next?
Love it. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Stephen Lee Bruner, who goes by Thundercat. He spoke with Brianna Younger, a music editor at The New Yorker. Jesus, take the wheel.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.